Chapter 1. The Future of China. Are Chinese leaders serious about displacing the United States as the number one power in Asia, in the world? What does number one mean? How will China's behavior toward other countries change if China becomes the dominant Asian power? What is China's strategy for becoming number one? What are the major hurdles in executing that strategy? How much urgency do China's leaders feel about achieving primacy in their region and beyond? How do China's leaders see the U.S. role in Asia changing as China becomes number one? Is the double-digit growth that China has maintained over three decades likely to continue for the next several decades? Will China become a democracy? Will China actually become number one? How should one assess Xi Jinping? These questions are central to the likely course of Asian and world history. Lee Kuan Yew's thoughtful answers in this chapter reflect decades of observing and analyzing China and its leaders. Are Chinese leaders serious about displacing the United States as the number one power in Asia, in the world?
Of course. Why not? They have transformed a poor society by an economic miracle to become now the second largest economy in the world, on track, as Goldman Sachs has predicted, to become the world's largest economy in the next 20 years. They have followed the American lead in putting people in space and shooting down satellites with missiles. Theirs is a culture 4,000 years old, with 1.3 billion people, many of great talent, a huge and very talented pool to draw from. How could they not aspire to be number one in Asia, and in time, the world? Today, China is the world's fastest developing nation, growing at rates unimaginable 50 years ago, a dramatic transformation no one predicted. Chinese people have raised their expectations and aspirations. Every Chinese wants a strong and rich China, a nation as prosperous, advanced, and technologically competent as America, Europe, and Japan. This reawakened sense of destiny is an overpowering force. The Chinese will want to share this century as co-equals with the U.S. It is China's intention to be the greatest power in the world. The policies of all governments toward China, especially neighboring countries, have already taken this into account. These governments are repositioning themselves because they know that there will be consequences if they thwart China when its core interests are at stake. China can impose economic sanctions simply by denying access to its market of 1.3 billion people, whose incomes and purchasing power are increasing. Unlike other emergent countries, China wants to be China and accepted as such, not as an honorary member of the West.
What does number one mean? How will China's behavior toward other countries change if China becomes the dominant Asian power?
At the core of their mindset is their world before colonization and the exploitation and humiliation that brought. In Chinese, China means Middle Kingdom, recalling a world in which they were dominant in the region. Other states related to them as supplicants to a superior, and vassals came to Beijing bearing tribute. For example, the Sultan of Brunei, who carried silk as his offering, but who died there 4 centuries ago and now has a shrine in Beijing. Will an industrialized and strong China be as benign to Southeast Asia as the United States has been since 1945? Singapore is not sure. Neither are Brunei, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam. We already see a China more self-assured and willing to take tough positions. The concern of America is what kind of world they will face when China is able to contest their preeminence. Many medium and small countries in Asia are also concerned. They are uneasy that China may want to resume the imperial status it had in earlier centuries, and have misgivings about being treated as vassal states, having to send tribute to China as they used to in past centuries. They expect Singaporeans to be more respectful of China as it grows more influential. They tell us that countries big or small are equal. We are not a hegemon. But when we do something they do not like, they say, "You have made 1.3 billion people unhappy. So please, know your place."
What is China's strategy for becoming number one?
The Chinese have concluded that their best strategy is to build a strong and prosperous future and use their huge and increasingly highly skilled and educated workers to outsell and outbuild all others. They will avoid any action that will sour up relations with the U.S. To challenge a stronger and technologically superior power like the U.S. will abort their peaceful rise. China is following an approach consistent with ideas in the Chinese television series The Rise of Great Powers, produced by the party to shape discussion of this issue among Chinese elites. The mistake of Germany and Japan was their effort to challenge the existing order. The Chinese are not stupid. They have avoided this mistake. Overall GDP, gross domestic product, not GDP per capita, is what matters in terms of power. China will not reach the American level in terms of military capabilities anytime soon, but is rapidly developing asymmetrical means to deter U.S. military power. China understands that its growth depends on imports, including energy, raw materials, and food. China also needs open sea lanes. Beijing is worried about its dependence on the Strait of Malacca and is moving to ease the dependence. The Chinese have calculated that they need 30 to 40, maybe 50, years of peace and quiet to catch up, build up their system, change it from the communist system to the market system. They must avoid the mistakes made by Germany and Japan. Their competition for power, influence, and resources led in the last century to two terrible wars. The Russian mistake was that they put so much into military expenditure and so little into civilian technology. So their economy collapsed. I believe the Chinese leadership has learned that if you compete with America in armaments, you will lose. You will bankrupt yourself. So avoid it. Keep your head down and smile for 40 or 50 years. To become competitive, China is focused on educating its young people, selecting the brightest for science and technology, followed by economics, business management, and the English language. My first reaction to the phrase peaceful rise was to tell one of their think tanks, it is a contradiction in terms. Any rise is something that is startling. And they said, what would you say? I replied, peaceful renaissance or evolution or development. A recovery of ancient glory, an updating of a once great civilization. But it is already done. Now the Chinese have to construe it as best they can. A year ago, a Chinese leader in his 70s asked me, do you believe our position on peaceful rise? I answered, yes, I do, but with one caveat. Your generation has been through the anti-Japanese war, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, the Gang of Four, and finally, the Open Door Policy. You know there are many pitfalls, that for China to go up the escalator without mishaps, internally you need stability, externally you need peace. However, you are inculcating enormous pride and patriotism in your young in a restored China. It is volatile. The Chinese leader said they would ensure that the young understood. Well, I hope they do. Somewhere down this road, a generation may believe they have come of age before they have. China's strategy for Southeast Asia is fairly simple. China tells the region, come, grow with me. At the same time, China's leaders want to convey the impression that China's rise is inevitable and that countries will need to decide if they want to be China's friend or foe when it arrives. China is also willing to calibrate its engagement to get what it wants or express its displeasure. China is sucking the Southeast Asian countries into its economic system because of its vast market and growing purchasing power. Japan and South Korea will inevitably be sucked in as well. It just absorbs countries without having to use force. China's neighbors want the U.S. to stay engaged in the Asia-Pacific so that they are not hostages to China. The U.S. should have established a free trade area with Southeast Asia 30 years ago, well before the Chinese magnet began to pull the region into its orbit. If it had done so, its purchasing power would now be so much greater than it is, and all of the Southeast Asian countries would have been linked to the U.S. economy rather than depending on China's. Economics sets underlying trends. China's growing economic sway will be very difficult to fight. China's emphasis is on expanding their influence through the economy. In the geopolitical sense, they are more concerned now with using diplomacy in their foreign policy, not force.
What are the major hurdles in executing that strategy?
Internally, the chief challenges are culture, language, an inability to attract and integrate talent from other countries, and in time, governance. Even if China were as open to talented immigrants as the U.S., how can one go there and integrate into society without a mastery of Chinese? Chinese is a very difficult language to learn, monosyllabic and tonal. One can learn conversational Chinese after a few years, but it is very difficult to be able to read quickly. I do not know if China will be able to overcome the language barrier and the attendant difficulty in recruiting outside talent unless it makes English the dominant language, as Singapore has. Children there learn Chinese first, then they learn English. They might go to the U.S. as a teenager and become fluent, but they have 4,000 years of Chinese epigrams in their head. China will inevitably catch up to the U.S. in absolute GDP. But its creativity may never match America's, because its culture does not permit a free exchange and contest of ideas. How else to explain how a country with 4 times as many people as America, and presumably 4 times as many talented people, does not come up with technological breakthroughs? Can the Chinese break free from their own culture? It will require going against the grain of 5,000 years of Chinese history. When the center is strong, the country prospers. When the center is weak, the emperor is far away, the mountains are high, and there are many little emperors in the provinces and counties. This is their cultural heritage. Chinese traditions thus produce a more uniform Mandarinate. The biggest single fear China's leaders have is the corrosive effect of graft and the revulsion that it evokes in people. They are never quite sure when it will blow up. There will be enormous stresses because of the size of the country and the intractable nature of the problems, the poor infrastructure, the weak institutions, the wrong systems that they have installed, modeling themselves upon the Soviet system in Stalin's time. China faces enormous economic problems, a disparity in income between the rich coastal cities and the inland provinces, and an income within the coastal cities. They have got to watch that carefully, or they might get severe discontent and civil disorder. Technology is going to make their system of governance obsolete. By 2030, 70% or maybe 75% of their people will be in cities. Small towns, big towns, mega big towns. They are going to have cell phones, internet, satellite TV. They are going to be well informed. They can organize themselves. You cannot govern them the way you are governing them now, where you just placate and monitor a few people, because the numbers will be so large. Increasingly cheap and available technology and cascades of reverse migration are wising people up to the true story of the exploitation of China's heretofore isolated rural regions. And furthermore, the Chinese know that with their industrialization, every year 10 or plus millions will go into the new towns they are constructing for their people. If they change in a pragmatic way, as they have been doing, keeping tight security control and not allowing riots and not allowing rebellions and, at the same time, easing up, giving more provincial authority, more city authority, more grassroots power, it is holdable. China did not have to worry about the rest of the world when it was an empire. This time, it has to worry about the rest of the world because without the resources, the oil, the nickel, whatever, its growth will stop. Present-day China faces a very advanced North America, Europe, Japan, and a fairly developed Southeast Asia and India. China's leaders 30 years hence will know that although by 2050, China will be the biggest economy in GNP, gross national product, per capita, they will still be small, and technologically, they will still be way behind. So to get there, they must have a sense of realism. They have got to be like Singapore's leaders, with a very keen sense of what is possible and what is not. They must know that to dominate Asia is not possible. Straight-line extrapolations from such a remarkable record are not realistic. China has more handicaps going forward and more obstacles to overcome than most observers recognize. Chief among these are their problems of governance, the absence of the rule of law, which in today's China is closer to the rule of the emperor, a huge country in which little emperors across a vast expanse exercise great local influence, cultural habits that limit imagination and creativity, rewarding conformity, a language that shapes thinking through epigrams and 4,000 years of text that suggests everything worth saying has already been said, and said better by earlier writers. A language that is exceedingly difficult for foreigners to learn sufficiently to embrace China and be embraced by its society, and severe constraints on its ability to attract and assimilate talent from other societies in the world. While Singapore shares with China many of the core philosophical tenets of Confucianism, we worked over the past 40 years to establish English as our first language and Chinese as the second. Why? Certainly not by accident and without provoking strong opposition. We did so to open ourselves to the world and allow ourselves to engage and embrace the main forces of discovery and invention and creativity that occurred not only in the language but also in the mentality of English. We could do that in a small city-state with strong leadership. While I once advised a Chinese leader to make English the first language of China, clearly that is not realistic for such a great, confident country and culture. But it is a serious handicap.
How much urgency do China's leaders feel about achieving primacy in their region and beyond?
The Chinese are in no hurry to displace the U.S. as the number one power in the world and to carry the burden that is part and parcel of that position. For now, they are quite comfortable in being part of a larger group like the G20, Group of 20, where their views will be taken seriously and economic interests safeguarded. But the responsibility is shared among 20 member states. While there are no doubt voices calling for China to move more rapidly in establishing its superiority, demanding the respect that comes along with that standing, and exercising this role, the center of gravity among the leaders is cautious and conservative. They operate on the basis of consensus and have a long view. While some may imagine that the 21st century will belong to China, others expect to share this century with the U.S. as they build up to China's century to follow.
How do China's leaders see the U.S. role in Asia changing as China becomes number one?
The leadership recognizes that as a leading power in the region for the 7 decades since World War II, the U.S. has provided a stability that allowed unprecedented growth for many nations, including Japan, the Asian Tigers, and China itself. China knows that it needs access to U.S. markets, U.S. technology, opportunities for Chinese students to study in the U.S., and bring back to China new ideas about new frontiers. It therefore sees no profit in confronting the U.S. in the next 20 to 30 years in a way that could jeopardize these benefits. Rather, its strategy is to grow within this framework, biding its time until it becomes strong enough to successfully redefine this political and economic order. In the security arena, the Chinese understand that the U.S. has spent so much more and has built up such advantages that direct challenges would be futile. Not until China has overtaken the U.S. in the development and application of technology can they envisage confronting the U.S. militarily. What are the Americans going to fight China over? control over East Asia? The Chinese need not fight over East Asia. Slowly and gradually, they will expand their economic ties with East Asia and offer them their market of 1.3 billion consumers. Extrapolate that another 10, 20 years, and they will be the top importer and exporter of all East Asian countries. How can the Americans compete in trade? I do not see the Americans retreating from Asia, but I see Chinese power growing. The Chinese attitude is, we are not against you. We welcome an American presence. Because they know they cannot substitute for the Americans. And the countries here welcome the Americans. So they just wait and grow stronger. Economically and militarily, they may not catch up for 100 years in technology. But asymmetrically, they can inflict enormous damage on the Americans.
Is the double-digit growth that China has maintained over three decades likely to continue for the next several decades?
During the last three decades, China's economy has grown at the phenomenal rate of 10% per year, sometimes even exceeding 12%. Can China maintain such high rates for at least another decade? I think it can. China is starting from a lower base, and its 1.3 billion domestic consumers will keep rates up because their disposable incomes are growing.
Will China become a democracy?
No. China is not going to become a liberal democracy. If it did, it would collapse. Of that I am quite sure, and the Chinese intelligentsia also understands that. If you believe that there is going to be a revolution of some sort in China for democracy, you are wrong. Where are the students of Tiananmen now? They are irrelevant. The Chinese people want a revived China. Can it be a parliamentary democracy? This is a possibility in the villages and small towns. The Chinese fear chaos and will always err on the side of caution. It will be a long evolutionary process, but it is possible to contemplate such changes. Transportation and communications have become so much faster and cheaper. The Chinese people will be exposed to other systems and cultures and know other societies through travel, through the internet, and through smartphones. One thing is for sure. The present system will not remain unchanged for the next 50 years. To achieve the modernization of China, her communist leaders are prepared to try all and every method, except for democracy with one person and one vote in a multi-party system. Their two main reasons are their belief that the Communist Party of China must have a monopoly on power to ensure stability, and their deep fear of instability in a multi-party free-for-all, which would lead to a loss of control by the center over the provinces, with horrendous consequences, like the warlord years of the 1920s and 30s. I do not believe you can impose on other countries standards which are alien and totally disconnected with their past. So to ask China to become a democracy when in its 5,000 years of recorded history it never counted heads. All rulers rule by right of being the emperor, and if you disagree, you chop off heads, not count heads. But I agree that in this world of instant communication and satellites, you cannot have barbaric behavior and say it is your internal problem. But now on human rights, they have begun to talk. And they recognize that if they want to be respected in the world community, they want to win a certain status with the rest of the world. Not just advanced countries, but even the developing countries. Then they cannot behave in a barbaric fashion to their own people. China discovered that to run a modern state, it needed the rule of the law. It had a comprehensive set of legal codes by 2035, and found that a stable legal system, together with clear administrative rules, actually strengthened central authority. Erring provincial and local governments were brought to book through due process of law, a method more effective than the endless negotiations that had been the practice before. Also, with the rule of law, ordinary citizens are now protected from the arbitrary authority of officials. Business enterprises are also able to plan large, long-term investments. The independence of the judiciary took another 20 years to achieve in practice because historical tradition, which required magistrates as officers of the emperor to carry out imperial orders, was deeply embedded in Chinese officialdom. Li's 1993 prediction about how Chinese governance would operate in 2150.
Will China actually become number one?
Their great advantage is not in military influence, but their economic influence. They have the manpower to do things cheaper in any part of the world economically. Their influence can only grow and grow beyond the capabilities of America. The chances of it going wrong in China, if they have pragmatic, realistic leaders who are not ideologically blinkered, are about 1 in 5. I would not say 0, because their problems are weighty ones. System change, business culture change, reducing corruption, and forming new mindsets. The Chinese have figured out that if they stay with peaceful rise and just contest for first position economically and technologically, they cannot lose. The 21st century will see Asia recover its place in the world. Their progress in the last 30 years entitles East Asians, including the Chinese, to be optimistic about their future. Short of some major unforeseeable disaster which brings chaos, or breaks up China once again into so many warlord fiefdoms, it is only a question of time before the Chinese people reorganize, re-educate, and train themselves to take full advantage of modern science and technology. China will quicken the pace of its development by using inputs from the industrial and newly industrialized countries to catch up with and become first a fully industrialized and next a high-tech society, if not in 50 years, then in 100 years.
How should one assess Xi Jinping, the likely incoming president of China?
He has had a tougher life than Hu Jintao. His father was rusticated, and so was he. He took it in his stride, worked his way up the southern provinces quietly, and rose to become secretary of Fujian province. Then he went to Shanghai, and then to Beijing. It has not been smooth sailing for him. His life experiences must have hardened him. He is reserved, not in the sense that he will not talk to you, but in the sense that he will not betray his likes and dislikes. There is always a pleasant smile on his face, whether or not you have said something that annoyed him. He has iron in his soul, more than Hu Jintao, who ascended the ranks without experiencing the trials and tribulations that Xi endured. I would put him in Nelson Mandela's class of persons, a person with enormous emotional stability who does not allow his personal misfortunes or sufferings to affect his judgment. In other words, he is impressive.